persons who will be called as witnesses will be sworn in by the court reporter for testimony. There being none, that makes the matter pretty straightforward. Before hearing testimony from the witnesses, which there are none, we'll hear any opening arguments, statements the parties would like to make. Mr. Hutchison, you have 10 minutes to present your opening statement.
I'll waive opening and get arguing the motion and meeting if the board will allow me. Last week I filed a motion to deem the allegations in the complaint of the hearing that is pursuant to board statute 32924H. The board mailed the complaint of hearing by certified mail on December 16th, 2024, to respond address the record on file with the board. To date, the board has not received any response from respondent. The complaint of hearing was returned by USPS after being unclaimed for some time. So pursuant to board statute, state request the board the allegations submitted by the client vacate today's hearing.
Thank you. For the record again, last call for any witnesses on either side. In the event that there might have been witnesses, we would have had the opportunity for the board to question those witnesses. There being none, we will move forward, and I will invite the board to offer any questions to Mr. Hutchison relative to his motion to deem. Hearing none, this concludes the evidentiary portion of the formal hearing, and the board will now hear any closing arguments, which I assume is what you just did, in essence, was presented your motion to deem. Thank you. And I assume there are no further questions. And therefore, having heard the testimony and reviewed the evidence and arguments of the parties, the board will now discuss the case. The board can begin with a general discussion or entertain motions. The first item for discussion is the findings of fact.
Mr. Hutchison has filed his motion to deem, and there's which would, if granted, obviate the need for a hearing. So at this point, the board needs to entertain that motion to deem.
So we may consider that to be a motion and not require a motion beyond that.
So if the board were to be so inclined, the motion would be a motion to grant the state's motion to deem the allegations as contained in the complaint and notice of hearing, as admitted, and make the those allegations as the board finds them back in conclusion.
Okay, so we're combining it all into one.
Yeah.
Okay, and there being no witnesses, no questioning, seems rather straightforward, probably erring in the direction of over due diligence to make sure on the record that everybody had a chance to speak. But so based upon that, is there would a board member care to make a motion similar to the one you just heard?
Chairman, I'd like to move that we accept the state's motion to deem and the all the facts and findings
and conclusions.
And conclusions of law.
Then move that the proposed deem motion to deem and findings of fact and conclusions of law be accepted. Is there a second?
This is Mitchell Jurgensen. I second.
Jurgensen is seconded. Is there any further discussion of the motion? Hearing none, I believe a roll call vote is appropriate.
You can do it all in favor on this one, but this one will require a roll call.
Okay. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed by the same sign, hearing none, the ayes have a vote unanimously with 4 voting and 1 recusal.
So 1 absent.
Pardon me, absent. Thank you. Appreciate that correction.
So, Dr. Bennett, the item not for the board's consideration is based on the findings of fact. In conclusion, the flaw being submitted, the board now needs to determine the appropriate discipline. It is typical at this juncture for the board to hear argument from the state and from the respondent to respond to be present, but the respondent is not present. So hearing argument from Mr. Hutchinson would be appropriate.
Very good. So, Mr. Hutchinson, we will now hear your recommendations relative to disciplinary action.
Well, the point of hearing or raised out that respondent would have been derelict in his responsibilities holding the license, although that also, I don't have a specific recommendation for discipline.
Okay, thank you. And does the board staff have a recommendation relative to this one?
Mr. Chairman, to be consistent with how these matters have been handled in the past, the board has revoked the license for the board situation. The board staff recommends revocation.
Okay, thank you. So the board staff recommendation for revocation, we've had the opportunity to review these materials. By way of general discussion, I see that there were 26 attempts to contact the patient from this provider, 121 days was required to receive the first set of records. Last renewal was 2022. The attempts have been made through mailing address, email address, phone number, everything available with no response. So it would appear to me that we have just a no response here. And
as I mentioned in the past, Dr. William Morganas decided to go to Mexico. He just practiced in San Carlos, Mexico. So he really had to, I don't think he's going to only want Arizona license. So staff recommended to revoke it.
Okay. Is there any further discussion relative to options or disciplinary action other than the recommendation of revocation? Hearing none, I would entertain a motion to that.
Mr. Chairman, this is Dr. Kevin Lee. I move to accept the staff recommendation of revocation.
To move that Dr. Lee to revoke in this case, is there a second? Dr. Camacho has seconded that motion. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, a roll call vote will be appropriate. Ms. Vanderveen would please do so.
Dr. Henley?
Yes.
Mr. Mabel Rosenblum?
Yes.
Dr. Doris Camacho?
Yes.
Dr. Wayne?
Yes. Their vote is 4 ayes, 0 nays, and 1 absentee. The motion passes. And so the staff will move forward with the revocation process, which concludes the formal administrative hearing. The board's decision will be reduced to a written order and serve on the parties. Parties will have further appeal rights that will be explained in the board's order, and so this concludes this matter. Thank you, Mr. Hutchinson, for your input on this. We will now move to tab number, we'll move to the consent agenda. Items listed on the consent agenda are items 6, A through J, tabs number 2, 3, and 6. Items on the consent agenda appear with a recommendation from board staff. The board members have reviewed all the materials and recommendations, or have the opportunity to. We are prepared to vote on each matter as they appear on the agenda. Pulling the matter means that you are a party or complainant to the matter and do not agree with the recommendation, or you would like us for 5 minutes to address the board. If you wish to pull a matter, please raise your hand so I can note that you wish to pull this matter. And I have been lost from the Zoom meeting, so I cannot see if the hand is being raised via Zoom. So I see no hands raised in this room, but I'm going to give anyone on Zoom the opportunity. Can we confirm there has been no hand raised? So hearing none, I would entertain a motion to approve the recommendations from staff on the tab that I have just identified as items on the consent agenda.
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Lee, I move to approve the recommendations by the staff on the consent agenda.
The been moved for approval by Dr. Williams. Is there a second?
This is Mr. Turbinson.
Thank you, Mr. Turbinson. There's a motion and a second. For discussion, hearing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by same sign. 4-0. The consent agenda is approved. I believe now we're going to move forward to a second. We're going to switch the sequence here in light of our, the presence of our recorder and representative from the Attorney General's office. So let me find ourselves on the agenda.
Number five.
Correct. Here it is. Time is now 9:17 a.m. and we move to agenda item number, it is now 5, correct?
Yes.
5. The review, discussion, and possible action relating to the proposed findings of fact, proposed conclusions of law, and recommended decisions issued by the administrative law judge in board case numbers 2020-36 and 2022-002, Office of Administrative Hearing case number 24-002, TEA regarding Herbert Schoenstrom and issuance of a final decision. Legal representation will be provided to the board by Elizabeth Campbell of the Attorney General's Office. Casey Hutchison represents the state of Arizona and will speak with respect to this matter. If Dr. Schoenstrom is present, are you, can you please identify yourself or your counsel? Second call out for Dr. Schoenstrom or for Dr. Schoenstrom's counsel. Third call out, Dr. Schoenstrom or Dr. Schoenstrom's counsel is present. Please identify yourself. Hearing none, we will move forward to the consideration of the administrative law judge's recommended decision. Let the record reflect that all board members have been furnished with the administrative record of the formal hearing on this matter. Would each member please indicate, as your name is called, whether you have reviewed the administrative record for the formal hearing. Ms. Vanderveen, would you please call the name?
Dr. Kennedy.
I have reviewed.
Yes, I have reviewed. Dr. George
Johnson? Yes, I reviewed.
Dr. Wayne,
I have reviewed the material. Thank you. The board will now hear brief oral arguments from the party on the administrative law judge's recommended decision. Please understand this is not the time for you to re-argue your case. Please focus on the recommended penalty and any changes you are requesting to the AO to the administrative law judge's recommended decision. Each party will have 5 minutes. The state has the burden of proof in this matter and therefore shall present first. State will be allowed some time for a brief rebuttal following the presentation, if any, from the respondent licensee. Does Mr. Hutchison, does the state have a statement to make to the board?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the board, KTS, and the state. I will keep it brief. I don't mean anything closer to the 5 minutes. At the hearing for the administrative law judge on September 11th, 2024, well, the ALJ's decision pretty thoroughly and in the state too accurately summarizes the case, the facts, and the nature of the case. The state doesn't have any proposed modifications, and the state would just request the board accept the administrative law judge's decision as is.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Schoenstrom, just reaching out to make any statement for your legal representation. Hearing none, no rebuttal is required. Would it be appropriate, perhaps, to have our board benefit from a brief summary of the findings of the administrative law judge, or law judge, or should we just review the state web materials?
They have indicated that they have read the materials, so I think it is just appropriate for me at this point.
All right. Good. Thank you. Having reviewed the administrative law judge proposed findings of fact, conclusions of the law, and order in the case, the administrative record, and the arguments from the parties, the board will now deliberate. In the event that the board votes to consider modifications, the parties will have an opportunity to meet and confer regarding the proposed changes to the board's vote. That means if we choose to do anything but the recommendation of the administrative law judge, then both steps apply. So we first deal with the findings of fact. Is there a motion on the findings of fact?
Chairman, this is Dr. Kevin Mays. I move that the board adopt findings of fact, paragraphs 1 through 10, as recommended by the administrative law judge.
Thank you, Dr. Lee. It has been moved to adopt findings of fact as recommended. Is there a second?
Just a possible modification. I think are we moving to adopt 1 through 27?
I think the F, which is being, I'm guessing being read as was actually intended just to say fill in the blank.
Okay.
Sorry. And I didn't realize that issue until right now. So it was my script. I apologize for that. And I changed it going forward.
Thank you. And,
I didn't catch it
either. Dr. Lee, would you consider sending an amendment to that effect?
Yes, I'm sorry. Except paragraph 1 to 27. As recommended by the administrative law judge.
Thank you.
And I will second.
Been moved and seconded. I accept the finding of paragraph 1 through 27. And as recommended by the ALJ, is there any discussion? Hearing none, and again, I assume a roll call vote is appropriate in this case. We will have a roll call vote.
Dr. Kevin Lee?
Aye.
Mr. Michael
Ferguson?
Aye.
Dr. George
Camacho?
Aye.
Dr.
Wayne? Aye. That was 4-0 vote. The motion passes with one absence. The next issue for discussion is the adoption of the conclusions of law. Is there a motion on the conclusions of law? And I would assume that the same revision as well. All right, very well, just to be clear.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Kevin Lees, I move that the board adopt conclusions of the law, paragraphs 1 through 27, as recommended by the administrative law judge.
Thank you, Dr. Lees. Is this
just I think they're on the 11th.
Okay, let's get some clarity. Can we confirm that that's actually the case?
Yeah.
So nice to have an attorney. Dr. Lee?
Yes, I'd like to amend that to move the board as conclusions of law paragraphs 1 through 11 as recommended by the administrative law judge.
Thank you, Dr. Lee. And
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded for further discussion. Hearing none, we will again do a roll call vote.
Dr. Kevin Lee?
Aye.
Dr. Nicole Robinson?
Aye.
Dr. George
Mago? Aye.
Aye. The four ayes, no nays, one absence, the motion passes. Final issue for discussion is the board's order. The board may make a motion to accept the administrative law judge's recommended order or may make a motion to modify or reject it and substitute a different decision. Does any member wish to offer a motion to either accept the recommended order or to modify or reject the order stating the specific substitution process?
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Kevin Lee, I move to accept the recommended order.
Move to accept. That's right.
And just to clarify that up for revocation without modification.
That's correct.
Yeah, I second.
Been moved and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, again, roll call vote is appropriate.
Dr. Lee?
Aye.
Dr. George Camacho?
Aye.
Dr. Wayne
Bennett?
Aye. The vote is 4-0, with one absence, the motion does carry. I'm not sure that any rest of this is relevant because we have not modified. Is that correct?
And I'm sorry, that was again, it's my fault. The board had a proposed form of order already prepared in these zones. I think at this point it would be appropriate for the Mr. Vice Chair to announce that the board staff will prepare and issue a, an order as
direct
in the form and reflecting the
finding
of practice, which is
flawed
in order as
put
upon by the board.
Correct. So for the record, I could say what she said, but I should probably say that the board will follow this up with the preparation of a written order that clarifies in detail the actions taken by the board this morning. And I believe that's been successfully concluded. That. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Organizing the script here so I keep it on track. We are moving well. Next on the agenda is item 7, tab number 4, which is the initial action. Case number 2024-2022, Mr. Serendi. Mr. Serendi, are you present today?
Chairman, good to be here. Recuse myself.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Lee. Let the record note that Dr. Lee has recused himself today from this tab. Mr. Serendi is not present physically. Is Mr. Serendi present in the form of a Zoom attendee? Reaching out again for Mr. Serendi, please raise your hand or make yourself known via the internet or treasure. Third call up. Are you present? Hearing none, we are going to assume Mr. Serendi is not present. Ms. Hennedy, may we have a board question?
Yes, sir. The association backs an allegation from RFAC 1 operating as an unregistered chiropractic clinic, FAC 2 violating a federal or state statute or regulation application to the practice of chiropractic, any act or omission identified in ARS section 32.9.4A.
Thank you. Since the respondent is absent and is not responding to the complaint, the board will now begin deliberation. Mr. Kirkson, would you like to start?
Sure. I guess I have a question for board staff. Has there been communication between the doctor
or Mr. Kirkson? To provide some context, this clinic, the Joint Red Mountain, was registered as a business entity until June 1st of 2020, and then they failed to renew. Then the board received a complaint that involved a patient at the clinic, and that's when the board staff identified that they were no longer registered. There's been multiple communications dating back to a year where the board staff worked with him to submit an application to extend the referral. He paid the invoice in the form, but he's never completed the application where he provided the staff with the list of officers and directors of the organization, the list of doctors providing care for location, and then the subsequent renewal that was in June and May. And so when we have communication with him, it comes down to, I paid the money, I don't want you to contact me. And so we don't have the application to support that. And so we made multiple attempts, even recently, to let the voicemail saying he didn't understand why the board keeps contacting him, that in his mind the matter is resolved. He doesn't understand why we keep trying to reach out and why we keep seeing it to him.
And I guess that's just my concern with the consent agreement is, you know, probably just going to, like, he's going to just say.
The option is, because he's not here, to use 7, right, and he's wrong territory. I believe it is a class 6 felony to be operating a non-licensed power parking place, so the board today could issue a cease and desist order, and forward the matter on to law enforcement.
So that would be the heaviest taxes we would consider doing. Just by way of comment, the only response that we have, thank you, ma'am, the only response that we have had is basically, as Ms. Bernardy said, wrote a check and it said, quit bothering me. It's obviously a far greater responsibility than that, and it's being that this is a potentially a classic felony, it's a serious matter, and we need to be taken seriously. Dr. Thomas, any discussion?
Well, I think at this point, if you haven't responded, you give them the threat that you don't move, or just take your license away and move.
Yeah, it's a serious thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's, if you get law enforcement involved, there may be more of an effort on his part to understand the law and take things a little more seriously.
Well, and this is the Armed Forces, we have our concern that we talk to him and he doesn't know this, what this is about. He says he's properly licensed in terms of being registered with the Arizona Corporation. But he held a business entity license until he was born in 2020. And so I don't understand what this is connected in regards to that, because it's not something new.
So just for sake of discussion, Mr. Hutchison can help us with this. We're dealing with regulating a business entity, a person who is not a DC.
Right.
So this kind of complicates the enforcement picture. So I would like maybe to get some clarity on that in terms of what our actions, what's enforceable and what's not. I mean, we couldn't, put them on probation or do the kinds of things that we would ordinarily do to a PC provider. But could you help us with that?
That's correct. So the board doesn't have jurisdiction over the non-licensee owner operator of the business entity itself, just over the business entity's offering chiropractic services. The statute provides that the board can impose discipline consistent with the Practice Act. So all the discipline available to the board to the entity, but because the entity has been lapsed for some time, it flows her to, like, if someone was unlicensed and practicing chiropractic, and as Ms. Mandry said, because they don't have a license, there isn't really one to discipline, so it would really be sort of a cease and desist or some kind of injunction to the board to go that way. And then also the board statute in the disciplinary statute 924, the grounds for discipline, provides that the board shall report allegations of evidence of criminal wrongdoing to the appropriate criminal justice agency. So it's not the most clearly written statute, but if the board finds that there are allegations of evidence of criminal wrongdoing, then it is a mandatory reporting requirement.
So that's the shall that's in there.
That is correct.
Not may, it's shall. And I think we are, certainly if we were to make a requirement that's specific to this case, that would be evident, and it was non-compliant, that would be evident. The other question that I have for legal counsel is this, with regard to, our board has gone through extraordinary measures to try and get this matter resolved, to the point of being accused of being a nuisance. My thought here is, two things. Number one, do we have the opportunity to offer a consent agreement of some sort that might include him completing the application within a pretty specific time frame, and also requiring in the consent agreement that the cost of the investigation be paid by him.
What he could do is yes. So yes, he can, because what he's doing and requires business registration, and because he's held it before, what he could do is make his business registration renewal contingent upon certain requirements. If you structure a consent agreement that way, yes.
And there is any, is there, what if any limitations exist upon the kinds of requirements that can be placed upon there? I mean, you can't order quick ups or something like that, right?
Which it would have to be, yeah, so it's the options available to the board under its practice act. So it would be standard, continuing education or terms and conditions of probation that's suited to, although putting a business and casino on probation is a little bit different, but the statute provides that whatever discipline, as long as it exists for licensees, it also exists for business entities as well.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Well, that's pursuant to the consent agreement. He said, I'm not going to sign the consent agreement before the law enforcement agency and, you know, issue the pieces of this letter. But can we still put additional requirements on him, on his business person, because of the prior registration, to versus anyone else who's any other business that's registering?
You mean just in a standard renewal?
Yeah.
It would have to be, it would have to be consistent with the short answer, no. Right. But if you did it in a consent.
Right.
You could just deny renewal, though. And factor in, you know, these reasons exist for he refused to comply in the past. And I would have to, I'd have to look more closely at the business entity statutes, because it's a lumpful amount. But if someone has to apply to the board for a business entity registration, then it's not given, the board to deny it and essentially not allow them to renew, doesn't meet whatever requirements or appropriate
given
the circumstances.
Yes, sir.
I can't open the detail. I read it, but I can't open it right now. It reminds me. It says I'm offline. Anyway, but according to the what I'm reading here, it means he's had a lapse in not registering his business. Is that correct?
It's
2022.
Okay. And basically, this would be considered an app in this registration, the time frame there?
Yes.
Okay. So basically, at this point, he's no longer registered and then cannot offer any services as far as this chapter goes.
That's right.
So I think at this point, if this guy refuses to do what he's supposed to do, then it's just put an injunction and stop him, at the doorstep, or send him another letter.
Mr. Chairman, the sense where I'm kind of going is I think the consent agreement idea is sounds nice, but there's no reason for him to agree to that. I mean, and so I think maybe if it gets to the point he's, you know, send a cease and desist letter and he either ignores it, where we could maybe consider an injunction or law enforcement, whatever happens there, if he reapplies, maybe it could be brought back to the board on what do we do now. He's reapplying and it's, you know, trying to meet all of our requirements, and, you know, we bring him here and say, well, what's going on, what happened, and we're willing to then have a consent agreement discussion because now we got your attention. But I think just sending him something now, he's going to blow us off, and then it's kind of a two-dollar step.
So how about this? I hear and like everything that you're saying. I don't like having to come back and rehash the same issues all over again another time. But maybe we can kill two birds with one stone to the extent that if we were to offer a consent agreement that if not complied with within 10 days, 15 days, or have you, would result in an immediate cease and desist and referral to law enforcement.
That's probably the option.
So basically, the agreement that if not signed within 10, 15 days or whatever, then refer to law enforcement. You could do that.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
The other thing the board might need to consider, depending on how it goes, is you may have to address the doctors that are currently working in the clinic, and they are working in an unlicensed chiropractic clinic, and in fact, you do require that they are aware of that and should be practicing.
I love that. That's part of it. It's actually also part of the contingency of the part of the consent agreement, is to say, if you have not signed a consent agreement, which would consist of updating your business application and having some agreement with regard to payment of the investigatory costs, that the following will happen. You will be issued a cease and desist order, you will be turned over to law enforcement, and the providers that work in your clinic will be advised that they are operating in an unlicensed facility. Could that cover the basis there?
You could do that because they have reporting requirements for themselves as
licensees. And I don't favor just lopping, you know, taking aggressive action immediately because of the fact that we've got doctors there that probably don't even know this is happening or operating in good faith. Mm-hmm. I would rather, you know, not put the issue on them that's not their issue. But you need to be surprised if it doesn't comply with it. So, how's that sound?
But then, if a guy realizes that there are lots of many doctors are under there, but that's true, or guidance.
Are we able to make those doctors aware that we're offering a consent agreement?
Well, I think until the consent agreement is signed, it's still a sort of part of the investigative file that concerns only the business entity itself, but I don't think
so. Okay. I'm not an attorney, but that's what it sounds like to me, too, is that if we were to start sending letters to the employer, having not given their to the employees, not having the contractors or whatever the relationship
not getting nervous to that.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, are we arriving at a motion that might look like offering a consent agreement? What kind of time frame to signature are we contemplating?
90 days?
Oh, that's not a lot of weight.
30 days? That would be that. Oh, 10 days.
From receipt of the
So the consent agreement to be, if not signed within 10 days of receipt, that would state that the consequences of not signing would be immediate cease and desist, referral to law enforcement, and advice to the chiropractors working in whatever capacity in the clinic. And the requirement of the signing the consent agreement would be to meet all business entity registration costs and to have in place a payment plan. Or do we want to require immediate payment or some agreeable to staff payment?
I would say, since you do have under your authority the issuance of a penalty plus the cost of the investigation.
Okay, and I believe the rule or statute says that it's
per violation. So you could issue a, so then if three, at least
three violations.
So we could issue a civil penalty of up to $3,000. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't necessarily have to do that. What's your pleasure relative to that?
I think that's not paying attention at all, but then something could happen in that matter. Don't wait for the move.
So we do, sorry, I'm not allowed to let you hear your deliberation. Thank you for being interested, though. With regard to the number, gentlemen, doctor, 1, 2, 3.
I'm not an attorney.
The 1,000 still has the penalty recommended by the staff.
What's the cost of investigation, which is probably going to be pushing that same number, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
the time to pay that would be, that could be 90 days or something.
90 days, yeah.
On signing the consent agreement, then you have 90 days to comply with the consent agreement's terms, requirements.
Okay.
Or do you think?
No, that sounds good. That's fair, yeah.
So then who would set the mouthful? Can we entertain a motion to authorize staff to prepare that as just discussed, or do we want to memorialize it?
Would your motion be to offer the applicant a consent agreement to complete the required business and chamber registration and get all required and necessary fees associated with the application, plus a costly investigation at $1,000 civil penalty to be paid within 90 days and require the application to be submitted within 10 days of receipt of signature on the consent agreement, or I'm going to rephrase that, within 10 days of signature on the consent agreement. If not, direct board staff to issue a cease and desist order and forward the matter to appropriate law enforcement.
Except for one little extra thing. They also have to comply with the re-registration of, I didn't hear that they also have to comply with re-registration of the business.
Oh, and
complete
the application.
Okay, I didn't hear that. Okay.
Just the one addition being that in the consent agreement, there's a statement of the consequences of not signing the consent agreement within 10 days, and also the final thing that board staff would do if it's not signed, what the consent agreement would warn the clinic of is that all individuals, all practitioners associated with the clinic would be notified of the unlicensed staff.
So, one more time. Offer the business investigation consent agreement to the submission of a prior renewal application and the required necessary fees for the registration, including the cost of the investigation plus a $1,000 civil penalty, the penalty and the cost of investigation to be paid within 90 days of signing the consent agreement. The application will be due within 10 days and include in that if not signed, the staff will be directed to issue a cease and desist order on the clinic, and that the matter will be forwarded to the appropriate law enforcement agency.
Compliance within 10 days of receipt of the letter.
With compliance within 10 days of receipt of the consent agreement.
And
staff will notify that if not signed, and we're a cease and desist order will be issued and a matter will be forwarded to the appropriate law enforcement.
Yes. I have one addition to that mouth.
We did like two formal hearings to get time to speak.
I think you need to include in the consent agreement, if complied with all the terms of the consent agreement, then grant registration to give you a jurisdiction for the jurisdictional clerk. Otherwise,
would you, for what?
So you can have jurisdiction to offer the consent agreement. If you comply with the consent agreement, then we will grant you your registration renewal. That way, you'll have jurisdiction.
Okay.
Okay, another time too?
Okay.
I have this memorized.
The motion is to offer the respondent a consent agreement to be signed within 10 days of receipt. If not signed, it's the direct board and include in the consent agreement that if not signed, the board of faculty is going to be in the social order and form of the matter to the appropriate law enforcement. That agreement would contain the requirement to complete a business entity application paid for the cost of the investigation plus $1,000 total penalty to be paid within 90 days. If the respondent agrees to sign a consent agreement, the board will issue the business entity registration. And if he does not sign, staff will direct the issue of each individual or more matters to the appropriate law enforcement. Back in motion.
Yeah.
Add a motion.
That also includes notification of the any licensees that may be working there.
Oh, yes. Does that
include?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
We have an amended motion. Let's hurry and get a second. We have a second. Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion motion? Hearing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed by the same sign. The vote is 3 ayes and 1. Recusal.
The motion is 3 ayes, 1 absent, 1 recusal.
Thank you very much. The motion passed. Dr. Lee, welcome back. Whew. You know what? We are ahead of schedule, and the next item is our board training. So based upon that, we will take a quick 10-minute break. Please feel free to stand up and walk around, and let's be back here at, we'll make it a 12-minute break and be back here at 10:05. Story of my life. Okay, it is 10:05. We are resuming our board meeting. And next on the item agenda is item 17, which is a training for board members and board staff on trauma informed approach. By Dr. Charles Green, D.C., a CBI education. You may recall the board received direction from the governor's office regarding how the board interacts with complainants and ensuring that our process and procedures included a trauma informed approach to its investigation and its process. This is the first training on this topic with the objective of the board to continually improve its investigation and complaint approach. I would like to introduce Christopher Green, D.C. Dr. Green brings clarity to challenging issues. Certified in auditing, documentation, and compliance, Dr. Green has assisted state and federal agencies in complex cases involving fraud, sexual misconduct, and scope of practice. For over 10 years, Dr. Green has served chiropractic licensing boards in multiple states in the capacity of practice monitor and expert consultant. Using 30 years of clinical experience with unique skills in compliance and auditing, Dr. Green has been a featured speaker for organizations including the Federation of Chiropractic Licensing Boards. With a passion for helping patients find lasting solutions for neck and back pain, Dr. Green takes a special interest in the effect of metabolic syndrome and chronic inflammation as compounding factors for musculoskeletal pain. We are honored to have Dr. Green present for us on this important subject matter. Dr. Green, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much, and it is a real honor to be here. And I did not know that there would be chiropractors here that are doing continuing education, and I am really excited for you folks that are here, because the information that I'm going to share with the board and you as well is really important. It's really timely. It's not too well known in the chiropractic community, but that's changing, and that's part of the reason that we're here. And just for my benefit, are there any of you that are doing CE that are just like new licensees? You've only been practicing for a year or two, maybe just out of school. Is there anybody like that? No? Yeah? Okay. Oh, great. Okay. A couple hands go up. Fantastic. Well, I'm really excited to have you here because this is going to be important information for you to know as you go into your career. And then those of you who might have hair that's more my color, don't think that you don't need to know this either, because it's super important. So that being said, the title of this presentation that I have for you is called First Steps for a Trauma-Informed Licensing Board. And I'm going to use the term Trauma-Informed Approach, TIA. It's also often used interchangeably with the term Trauma-Informed Care, TIC. So whether it's TIA or TIC, we're really just talking trauma-informed and what does that mean, and there's a lot to know about it. So let me just show you what the objectives will be as we go through our time together. And we're going to talk about some definitions. I'll go over some statistics. We always have to have those. From a clinical perspective, we're going to talk about the impact on health. And I know that there's at least one public member on the board. And don't worry, I'm going to like really bring this down to a level that you get it, and also all the chiropractors that don't know much about trauma-informed care, that they'll get it as well. So this is definitely not going to be something where you're like, oh, my gosh, I have no idea what you're talking about. We will work through that. We'll talk specifically about trauma-informed care within the chiropractic clinic, and then how it relates. You know, we came into this from a regulatory enforcement perspective, and how it factors into that and investigations. And then finally, I'll have three steps for implementation, some takeaway for you, so we'll touch on that. Just a word real quick about me. You heard in the intro, it's funny when I was listening to you read that introduction for me, I'm like, oh, those numbers are kind of old. Actually, I've been doing the expert consultant for boards for over 13 years now, and I've been licensed for many years longer than 30. So I've been around the block a bit. But what allows me to really bring some unique insight to this conversation is because of the fact that I serve as an expert consultant and those various other titles that you see on there. And I've worked with a lot of different boards, including Arizona several years ago. I interact with board analysts, the investigators, admin. I interact with the Attorney General's office quite a bit, district attorneys, federal level enforcement agencies. And so it allows me to hear the perspective from all of these different people that are involved with the enforcement and regulatory process. And it's really helpful because, for example, not in Arizona, but there's a law called Marcy's Law. It started in California. I think it's been adopted by 10 other states, and they're looking to expand it. It's called the Victims Bill of Rights. That plays a part in the enforcement process. And I was just having a conversation yesterday with somebody in a regulatory agency about that and how it factors into the investigation process. So I really hope to share all of that insight with you as we go through this. So when we look at trauma-informed approach, and that little icon's like the computer, you know, loading. I was trying to pair some Bluetooth devices this morning on all my tech that I have in my room right here, and some of it was not pairing, which is frustrating. And if you feel like you're that loading bar on the computer where it's like, oh, my gosh, I've never heard of trauma-informed approach. What the heck is that? Don't worry. You're not alone. There's many within healthcare that are kind of like deer in the headlights. What is trauma-informed approach? So one of the places that you'll definitely want to go to, and I'll forward links for all of this to the board so you all can access these documents. But this one, so SAMHSA is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And this is for sure a default document as it relates to trauma and trauma-informed approach. And this concept of trauma, the definition that comes out of the SAMHSA document that I'm showing you, says this. It says trauma results from an event, these are the three E's, from an event, series of events, or a set of circumstances that is experienced by an individual as physically or emotionally harmful or life-threatening, and that has lasting adverse effect on the individual's functioning mental, physical, social, emotional, or spiritual well-being, which that's a mouthful, and we could just kind of chew on that for a bit. And think like from a chiropractor perspective, how do we encounter that? Like, do our patients, are they changed physiologically as a result of trauma? And we'll talk about that a little bit more later. But just kind of, you know, getting an idea of what do we mean when we say trauma. And then also for you in Arizona, your governor has made trauma something of a focus. And under trauma-informed care, Arizona is committed to ensuring trauma-informed care becomes a standard for supporting children and families across Arizona. It's interesting that they use that word standard, because I'll touch on a little bit later this idea of standard of care. So as it relates to trauma and trauma-informed approach, you know, from a regulatory perspective, enforcement is all about standard of care. And whether you're an investigator or you the board or you have an expert who helps to tease apart what standard of care should be relative to whatever you're doing, you know, a complaint of negligence or something. You know, one of the questions that we really have to ask is, at what point does trauma-informed approach become standard of care? Like, when are we going to say, you know, we need our providers to be having this be one aspect of what they should be looking, you know, from the same perspective of like vertebral artery dissection, VAD. You know, what is standard of care relative to assessing for VAD? So trauma-informed care is something for the board. As you talk about, you know, agenda for upcoming years, like, what are we going to do with trauma-informed care? And just to kind of give you a, not to put any pressure on you, Ohio, the state of Ohio, they already have trauma-informed approach as mandated CE. And for anybody who's worked within enforcement, you know, that doesn't just like happen tomorrow. Hey, yo, let's make that a regulation and have that be mandated CE. That takes some time to actually put ink to paper on that. And so Ohio, they're way ahead of the curve, and they'd definitely be a great board to resource as you start to decide what you're going to do with trauma-informed care. So let's talk a little bit as far as statistics go. And these stats are coming from World Health Organization, and they have numbers relative to trauma. I'm going to define trauma for you in just a minute. But one instance is one instance or more population-wise, 70% of the population, four or more, 31%. In the U.S., 90% is like, wow, those are big numbers. We'll pull that apart in just a second. But one thing I really want to take a moment and read through these is the impact on the individual from trauma. And so if you've heard this thing called the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, okay, don't worry, folks that don't know what that means. All it is the fight or flight response. And so when you are doing the fight or flight response, you know, you're overwhelmed by a situation, this HPA axis kicks on, your physiology changes in your body, hormone levels, heart rate, all that kind of stuff. And for people who have a history of trauma, essentially that switch gets stuck in the on position. And so if you think of yourself, and maybe you've experienced that, you know, like anxiety or depression or, you know, stress, and how that feels to have it for a prolonged period of time, then you can start to look at all these impacts thinking, okay, so they're stuck in fight or flight. All right, so emotional, difficulty regulating emotions. That makes sense. Emotionally numb, depression and anxiety. I'm reading these different columns that are on this slide. Post-PTSD, what about behavioral? How might they be impacted in that way? Substance use and abuse could certainly be a factor. You know, so you chiropractors in the room, be just thinking about your patient as you're taking a history. And one of the things that you should be thinking too is like, man, I don't know if I'm really inquiring or being sensitive to these sort of things in the patient history as I dialogue with them. And just a preface too, you don't necessarily want to ask a patient about trauma right out of the gates either. That can be what we call re-traumatizing. We'll pull that apart more in just a minute too. But this definitely requires an understanding of trauma and how to properly approach it. But first you have to know how to recognize it. So they may have self-destructive behaviors, avoidance of situations, people and places. Physically, what do they look like? There can be symptoms resulting from emotional stress, which could include headaches. Chiropractors see patients with headaches. high blood pressure, fatigue, hyperarousal resulting in muscle tension and insomnia. It's like, oh my gosh, total chiropractic patient right there. How about developmental? It impacts the varies depending on the age group. Children and elderly are at greatest risk. With the Arizona governor's statement on trauma-informed care, it seems as though it reads as though the focus is more on children, but it affects the whole lifespan. So we certainly don't want to just think children. Changes occur in brain development, which carry through the lifetime, of course. Cognitively, there can be impaired short-term memory. That's that HPA axis stuff kicking in. There can be, and by the way, too, that impaired short-term memory, that's a factor as it relates to the investigator. So for the investigator, investigating both, like when you dialogue with the respondent and also the complainant, they're recounting of like a time sequence, just the sequential events, can be altered simply because folks who have a history of trauma or have been exposed to trauma, their mind's ability to recount events sequentially is altered. So that's really important to consider, because if it doesn't make, if you can't make heads or tails for like the complainant, especially like sexual misconduct, something of that nature, and it doesn't add up, it's really important to know that somebody who has had trauma could indeed be recounting accurately for somebody who has trauma, but relative to the factual timeline, it may not make sense. If you're starting to think, wow, there's a lot to know here, there is. Decreased focus or concentration, feeling alienated or ashamed, dissociation, depersonalization, flashbacks are common. And then on an interpersonal level, there could be family problems, difficulty trusting others. And so if you're dealing with a respondent who they themselves have a history of trauma, difficulty trusting others and compliance on their part could be an effect of trauma that they may have had themselves, which just means that our job is even more demanding from the regulatory perspective, because it wouldn't be fair for us to not think, statistically they could have a history of trauma, which could cause them to respond in a different way than we'd like to see, but that doesn't mean that they're to blame. So once again, it's one more thing to consider. And then, of course, on a spiritual level, depression, loneliness, abandonment, loss of faith, and just having a loss of appreciation for life. So that's an important one to just kind of get a sense of, like, what does trauma do to an individual? So you'll see this term. It's ACEs, A-C-E, and it stands for Adverse Childhood Events. And that's a really important one to know, because you're going to hear that a lot when you start to read into trauma material. And it came out of a study in 1995 to 97. I'm here in Southern California right now, so down the road from where I am at in San Diego, Kaiser Permanente did a large study, 17,000 folks, and they did physical examination and did a survey asking about childhood experiences. And so the material I'm going to show you right now, the information came out of that original Kaiser Permanente ACEs study. And so they asked 10 different questions, and there was 5 on a personal level and 5 on a family member. Excuse me. And this has to do with the ACEs, the adverse childhood events. They involved physical abuse, verbal abuse, sexual abuse, physical neglect, emotional neglect, and then relative to a family member, those are on the personal. For a family member, alcoholism, domestic violence, incarceration, mental illness, and divorce. So you simply score it by a yes or no, and an ACE score would be the number of yeses that individual has. And so let's just say an ACE score of 4. Let's see what the impact is on that individual. So an ACE score of 4 shows those folks will be twice as likely to be a smoker, 2.4 times hepatitis, 4x increase on emphysema, bronchitis, COPD, 4.6 times depression, 7 times alcohol. I mean, some of these numbers, you start to think, this is incredible. This is no small thing. This is really serious. And especially when you look at that last one, which is 12x on suicidality. So this is certainly something not to make light of, only because the numbers are very significant. And here's another one to think about, too, is that ACEs don't occur alone, meaning that if somebody has one ACE, 87% of those folks are going to have two or more. Once again, the numbers are way more than insignificant. These are epidemic in regards to what we would be on our toes for just as we interact with our patients. So there's an increased risk of disease along with that. So just remember that HPA axis, you're in fight or flight. So if you're always turned on, you're stuck in the stress response, increased inflammatory, what we call cytokines, which are chemicals that your body makes that signal inflammation. So if you have a continuous stress response, then it makes sense that there's going to be increased things like cardiovascular disease. There's a strong association with heart disease, hypertension, and obesity. Autoimmune disease is a factor as well, makes sense, chronic inflammation. So if we have one or more ACE, they're going to have a 20% increased risk for autoimmune. Four or more, a 63% increase, which is really quite profound. And then finally, the other is to think about this, especially from the chiropractic perspective, is that ACEs increase the risk of chronic pain as well. So 84% of chronic pain sufferers report at least one ACE. And so for you chiropractors in the room and those of you who are not who know what chiropractic is and kind of have an appreciation for the patient base that chiropractors see, you'd be thinking, we can just about say that 84% of the folks that come into chiropractor's office have a history of trauma, just simply on the basis of this statistic alone. So as I mentioned, that HPA axis is that ACEs are associated with alterations in your nervous, endocrine, and immune systems. So it turns on that fight or flight response. You have a blunted response to psychosocial stress, means they're just kind of numbed out. And even an altered glucose regulation, which means diabetes? And the answer is yes. So you just look at this idea, picture that would put me in a stress response. So just to kind of give you a feel of that hypothalamic, pituitary, adrenal axis, you see those pictures there on the top in the center, and then the impact on the body, accelerated heart rate, increased blood pressure, glycogen to glucose in the liver, tunnel vision, digestion slows down, increased sweating, fast breathing, just to kind of give you a feel of what this impact is when you're in that fight or flight response. And the other thing that we see is an upregulation of that immune inflammatory response. So for those of you who are aware of these different indicators, C-reactive protein, tumor necrosis factor, interleukin-6, those all go up for the person who's exposed to stress. So far more than just like, we should be sensitive to this. It's like, no, there's like clinical issues that are associated with this. And once again, 64% of adults have experienced at least one type before the age of 18. What happened to that 90 or 70? This is coming out of the ACEs study itself. And so from the ACEs study, 64%, okay, so a little bit more conservative, but still tells us this is a large number of patients have at least one type before the age of 18, and 17.3%, I'm going to be generous and call it one out of, what would that be, five if they said 20%? So one out of five folks coming in a chiropractic office likely have four or more. Here you have the statistic coming out of your governor's office and says this. A recent survey by America's Health Rankings determined that over 30% of Arizona's children 0 to 17 have two or more ACEs. So you can see in the trauma-informed literature coming out of your governor's office in Arizona, here's that term ACEs. So now you're kind of ahead of the game because you have an appreciation of ACEs coming from that Kaiser Permanente study. So we get a little better feel for that. So how about the dollar impact? This is shocking. This is just last year, 2023. ACEs have a major impact on the health of our communities and a heavy financial burden. In this economic evaluation, U.S. adult population, 63% of adults have ACEs. Okay, we know that number. The national economic burden of ACE-related adult health conditions was $183 billion in direct medical spending. So as we face financial shortfalls and economic challenges, and we look at ACEs with a price tag direct medical of $183 billion, anything that we can do to help to reduce the burden from ACEs is helping all of us. So certainly chiropractors can play a part of that. So then the question becomes, are ACEs a big deal? Like, I've never heard of this. Like, what's going on with that? So here's just a couple. I would really encourage all of you, that book in the bottom left corner, that's on the left corner of your screen, called The Body Keeps the Score. That's should be like number one reference. And then right behind it is called The Deepest Well, written by Nadine Burke Harris. She is our first, Surgeon General here in California. Fantastic book about ACEs and the impact on health. And then California has, you can all access it, it's acesaware.org. If you went onto that website, for you, those of you who are chiropractors, you can actually get CE. I'm not sure if the Arizona Board accepts California CE, but it's also AMA CE. So if you accept medical CE, it will be knocking out some of your CE for you. But that aside, more importantly is you can get trained in ACEs and trauma and have a real formal understanding. I would highly recommend that. That's just a screenshot of where you can register to participate in the ACEs Aware training that they have on there. But one of the quotes that come out of that website is this: prolonged activation of the stress response systems that can disrupt the development of brain architecture. chronic stress changes the brain architecture for a child as they mature. That's a problem. And other organ systems, and increases the risk for stress-related disease and cognitive impairment well into the adult years. So when we see the connection with chronic disease and musculoskeletal pain, we start to look at this more and more, and we're like, hey, chiropractors, I'm elbowing. You can't see me elbowing right now. I'm elbowing the chiropractor next to me, and regulatory enforcement folks. Hey, like, we should probably be looking at this. We need to know more about this. And the reason why is because trauma survivors go to chiropractors. Why is that? Chronic pain, chronic disease, autoimmune disorders. Lots of chiropractors specialize in treating kids. So the children and the pediatric aspect of it. So as we dig a little deeper into trauma-informed approach, you're going to encounter what are called the four R's. And this comes out of that SAMHSA document that I showed you earlier. And it says this, trauma-informed approach. A program, organization, or system that is trauma-informed realizes, so that's the first R, the widespread impact of trauma and understands potential paths for recovery, recognizes the signs and symptoms of trauma in clients, families, staff, and others involved with the system, and responds by fully integrating knowledge about trauma into policies, procedures, and practices, and seeks to actively resist re-traumatization. It's the last one, but it really needs to be front of mind, and that is resist re-traumatization. So these four R's, realize impact of trauma, recognize signs and symptoms, respond by screening, treating, and referring, emphasize the referral from a chiropractic perspective, because certainly we have a scope issue if they require psychological intervention, and then importantly, resist re-traumatization. So this is, I'm very happy to say this. So just a quick show of hands, those of you who are recent graduates, did you get taught about trauma-informed approach in school? Did any of you? I can see you all up there. So Jared says, yeah. Are you the only one? Okay, cool. Well, good for you. I'm glad that you already know about this a little bit. Hopefully we're adding to it. So that's awesome. Glad to hear that. So this is another paper. I'll forward a link to it. It's free access. Our friend Stacy Salisbury and Kira Baca over at Palmer, I think this was just last year that they published this. And you can see the title, Adverse Childhood Experiences and Trauma-Informed Care for Chiropractors. Yay! A Call to Awareness and Action. And I want to tell you a little bit about this paper. You can see how they have listed the four R's there, trauma-informed care, realize, recognize, respond, resist. And I want to talk to you about these vignettes that they provide for the reader. And they take, so let me just flip back to this last slide. They have an A score of 1, 4, and 8. I want to show you the 8 and the 4, just to show you on the extreme side, because, of course, the highest score is 10. So here's a score of 8, and here's what the experiences were. Neglect, parental loss, household mental illness, domestic violence, household incarceration, verbal abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse. I mean, that sounds like a lot, but the fact of the matter is that is not an outlier. There's plenty of folks out there that have a past history that would include all of that. So then, who is this person? 50-year-old Caucasian male, middle class, white collar. Chronic back pain, so how are they producing chronic back pain? And they're looking to reduce opioid use. Comorbidities include depression, hypertension, diabetes, hypercholesterolemia, so it's a mouthful. Makes sense, though, when we're thinking about that sustained inflammation. Irritable bowel syndrome, coronary stenosis, stent surgery. So it's like, you know, we may think as we're looking at this patient. And by the way, as I read all that to you, that requires that the chiropractor takes a good history. You can't just blow through. You're like, okay, you're here for back pain. All right, let's get you on the table and start adjusting that. It's like, no, 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 no. No, you have to allow the time to do a proper history with these patients, and you can't rush through it. It requires that time. Is this overbearing and too much to ask of the chiropractor? I don't know. If you have all these comorbidities that could reduce the degree of improvement relative to chiropractic care and their low back complaint, what if they're really inflamed as a result of the trauma? You only get halfway there, and it's like, oh, well, we've got you as good as we could, when that's not really the case. Had we been sensitive to the history of trauma, and then could help refer them out to a proper, you know, provider, therapist, whoever. Okay, so as we dig down through this little vignette, and you look at the trauma-informed chiropractic care, so in the article, what Dr. Baca does is she gives you what this could look like, the realize, recognize, respond, and resist, those four R's. And so what does that look like? So realize, chronic pain, comorbidity from substance use may be due to physiologic change, right, in the HPA axis, chronic inflammatory state, and psychosocial factors related to ACEs. All right, we're starting to think, it's like pulling it together, like, okay, I'm starting to see how this works clinically. We recognize that depression and substance use, unhealthy lifestyle choices may be coping mechanisms related to ACEs. So how do we respond? Suggest an ACE screen. I would be careful about that. And the reason I say that is that unless you have a team of providers that you're going to refer that patient when they have an ACE score of 8, should they go to a therapist? Oh, yes. So unless you have that already lined up, then don't be taking an ACE score, because having them do the ACE score and asking, have you had all these things, and they're going, yes, 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 that in and of itself can be re-traumatizing. So you can see how you really have to think this out from a clinical perspective before you might include something like doing an ACE screen. So chiropractic care, I'm reading the respond section. Chiropractic is indicated by the exam. Counsel on lifestyle, we could for sure do that. For the diabetes and bowel disorder. Prescribe therapeutic exercise for the cardiovascular health? Absolutely. Refer to a nutritionist, for sure. Lifestyle coach and psychologist, underline the psychologist. So what about the resist part? Ask the patient what can be done to make them more comfortable. Reserve extra time for the appointment to reduce the likelihood of the patient feeling dismissed. So once again, you have to know these patients. And you have to take, that doesn't mean you're going to say, okay, I need an hour with that patient. That may not be reasonable in a clinical setting, but on the other hand, it is reasonable in you creating your plan of care. It's not put them in a time of day where you're just really rushed and you can't spend the time that's necessary for that particular individual. And then follow through with care plans, reevaluations. Make sure you're reassessing, talking about where they are with their care to avoid triggering abandonment trauma. So that's an extreme situation. Let's look at an ACE score of 4. So 35-year-old Hispanic female, lower class, blue collar, chronic low back pain and pelvic pain, anxiety and panic attacks, chronic low back pain, fibromyalgia. Sounds like a pretty typical chiropractic patient. We'll see plenty of folks that fit that description. So for the childhood experiences, this is important to really spend a moment here. Household mental illness and substance misuse within the house, domestic violence, and also sexual abuse. So let's look at what our four R's might look like in this particular case. So realize that chronic pain may be associated with the history of sexual trauma. So is it important for the provider to be sensitive to that? You're darn right it is. It's super important. Recognize that panic attacks may be a coping mechanism in response to the stress. I'm sorry, like the gardeners next door doing the neighbor's yard. If you guys can hear the lawnmower, I hear it. I hope you don't, but I apologize for that. It's like, go mow on the other side. All right, so I'm having a panic attack right now because the guy's mowing the lawn. So panic attacks may be a coping mechanism in response to stress. And so that, how do you respond? Okay, so ACE screen, same comment I made before. Chiropractic care, yes. Prescribed therapeutic exercises, of course. Refer to a psychologist and pain specialist would really, really, really be something to consider. And then the resist the re-traumatization is ask the patient again what can be done to make them more comfortable. Leave the door open or have another person in the room during the patient care. Really? Yes. A thorough explanation throughout the examination process. Okay, I'm going to be standing behind you now. Before you do, you're standing in front of me, Tone. We're going to evaluate your neck and your shoulders. I'm going to have you sitting on the table. I'll be standing behind you. I'm going to feel your neck and the muscles in your upper back. I'm trying to determine how much tension you have there, if there's any restriction in how the vertebra move. If at any time you feel uncomfortable with this, let me know. We'll stop. We'll figure out how to proceed with the examination. Are you okay with me doing that? Okay, great. Let's go ahead and do the next step. So it's as simple as that. I mean, that's not difficult. If you're not doing that already, you might consider, you that are in the clinic, you might consider thinking out your evaluation process to be more descriptive for the patient. Just as a rule of, now the dogs are barking at the gardeners. Just fantastic. So, sorry. All right. Let's see. Thorough explanation, warning prior to physical touch, avoid removal of clothing during the exam by asking the patient to shift clothes if needed to avoid triggering trauma from sexual abuse. Okay. Very good. Okay. And so then I have on here on the slide standard of care. So whether it's the investigator, whether it's an expert for the board, whether it's the board, you all that are on the board, is to be asking the question, maybe we need to consider these factors. Holy cow, they just started another lawnmower gun. So,
hey, Dr. Green?
Yeah.
Dr. Green, just Dr. Green, I want you to be, don't freak out about the noise because we can't hear anything.
Oh, I'm glad.
So, you know, don't worry. It's okay.
I appreciate that. So Zoom does a good job. You can tell that this is not my first rodeo on doing a presentation like this. Zoom has good sound counseling effects, so I'm glad to hear that because it sounds like they're going to blow the house over with that weed blower right now. So thank you for telling me that. I won't worry about it. Thank you. So if we look at this, we can really look at it from the perspective clinically and also regulatory. Is like, where are we at on standard of care? When does this cross that threshold? And when we have more studies coming out, like what they did at Palmer, and then we start seeing the literature leading the way, and then you have boards like Ohio that already have trauma-informed approach as part of mandated CE, then we start getting close to the point where we should be talking about it maybe in Arizona as well. I think your governor is like saying, yes, you should. So Once again, the four R's, the big one is resist. A trauma-informed approach seeks to resist re-traumatization of the patient as well as the staff and the board members and the admin staff and everybody involved. So then the question becomes, do ACEs play a role in board violations? Oh, that's interesting. That's an interesting question. So here in this study, adverse childhood experiences in trainees and physicians with professional lapses, like read between the lines like a board violation, implications for medical education or remediation. So what are we looking at here? 123 physicians and trainees, boundary violations, disruptive behavior, substance use disorder. And so what we found in the study is that one or more ACE was 70% of those in the study. Remember from the Kaiser Permanente numbers we have at 63%. So we're a fair amount above that. And then four or more is 22% as opposed to 17.3. So from a board perspective, when we are interacting with a respondent, we can look at this study and go, even more likely that the respondent has a history of trauma. Like, so what do we do with that? So increased ACEs equals increased professionalism issues. And so continues on. So in the conclusions where I have highlighted in the yellow, remediating individuals with professionalism issues and exposure to ACEs can be complicated by heightened responses to stressful stimuli. So their HPA axis is going to be in overdrive just simply by virtue of going through an enforcement process in and of itself. It's stressful. I mean, even like on your break when somebody had an issue with their license, it's okay, don't need to know who it was. I was getting stressed out listening to that, and I'm sure Alyssa was too, and the rest of you are like, oh my gosh, this is horrible. It's just a stressful situation for everybody involved. So they can have heightened response to stressful stimuli. They will likely have difficulty with collaboration and trust, meaning working with you, with us, and then also decreased self-efficacy, meaning that they don't implement the recommendations very well. And these are just all things not to look at as an excuse for the behavior. It's not that at all. But on the other hand, it does allow us to just say, okay, we need to take this into consideration. We need to be really clear with these folks. This is what we expect. This is the timeline that we expect it. Here's the deadline. You've been notified. We want you to succeed here. We're not trying to get you. But on the other hand, you need to comply as well. Why do we need to be that blunt about it? Because they need us to be, by virtue of the trauma, right? So you start to see how this makes more and more sense. So how does that play in the enforcement? How does trauma play a role in enforcement itself? Well, beyond the way that I just described, here's another study out of the Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Agency. Those of you who are at the FCLB district meeting, this is the study that I was referencing. And the introduction on it says this. There's been a growing global concern globally about the association between regulatory complaint processes and the mental health and well-being of the practitioner who is subject to a complaint. Previous research suggests that health practitioners involved in such a process can experience heightened levels of distress, anxiety, and shame, which impacts their personal lives and their families as well as their professional identity and practice. It makes sense. There have also been tragic cases of practitioners involved in complaint processes who have died by suicide. None of us want to hear that. And so then the question becomes like, okay, were there factors that contributed to that that perhaps we can reduce the impact of? And so here are elements of the complaint process that contribute to the practitioner distress. Poor communication, meaning between the board and the respondent. That's a challenge. And I want to tell you, I have so much appreciation for the board staff because I know you guys are overloaded, often understaffed, overworked, and it's like, look, we're doing the best we can. We're stressed out just trying to do all this. I get it, and I'm rooting for you. And that's why it's even more important that we work on this together. But poor communication is one factor. And then just the time frame that it takes to process a complaint. And then finally, the management of health-related concerns for the individual. Stigma, shame, and fear associated with the complaint process. So, let's see, what do I have for you on that? Yes, and that piece. So then finally, out of that study, they have this one statement, external factors in the practitioner's environment and personal situations significantly influenced experiences of distress. For those practitioners with a health-related concern, most commonly a mental health or substance use disorder, the protracted process, lack of control, and loss of hope of practicing again compounded their existing health issue. So, like, what do you do with that as a board? Because basically what you're saying is that if they have a history of trauma, if they have mental health issues, then the regulatory process itself could be putting gas on the fire as it relates to the respondent's health status. And this is just simply a suggestion from my part, on my part, from the perspective that I see things. But it's a place where maybe the board considers a psych eval on respondents just as a to get a baseline and make sure, you know, where they're at. It's a conversation to be had. I'm not saying you should be doing that. I know there are plenty of people like, whoa, we can't, you know, we're not going to order that. But it's just something to think about. How do we deal with that? So it's something to contemplate. So what about trauma-informed investigations? So there's FCLB, Federation of Chiropractic Licensing Boards. And so for you new licensees, FCLB is a group of all of the licensing boards. They all get together. There's district meetings, there's annual meetings, and so all the licensing boards in the states and also the provinces in Canada, and I think Australia and New Zealand, they come from all those places, they all get together. That's FCLB. And then there's FSMB, Federation of State Medical Boards, and it's the same kind of thing. All these licensing boards get together. Myself, a colleague of mine, Catherine Kovacot at PBI, she's the medical director, and then Sherry Paru, who is a physical therapist up in Oregon at the Oregon Physical Therapy Board. We did a presentation in April of this year at the FSMB annual meeting on the topic of a trauma-informed approach for licensees, for respondents. And a couple things that came out of that, I just want to share a couple bullets from that presentation for you. And that is that the enforcement process is likely incomplete without considering the possibility of trauma for the reasons that I just explained to you on the previous slides. And then a couple other considerations are this. Trauma often plays a role in violations. Well, yeah, we saw in that one study, don't lose my place here on the slides, but as it relates to the healthcare providers, there's a higher rate of ACEs. 70% have one or more. 22%, that's really high. 22% have four or more. You're pushing on one in four, you know, if I go conservative on that number. And so trauma plays a role in violations for that reason. The signs and symptoms of trauma can be found if you know what to look for. That's that ACEs study that Dr. Baca did over there, Palmer. And then remediation is an effective tool for wayward licensees. So that's a consideration as well. And then the cool thing, you know, I mentioned the Ohio Chiropractic Board. There's a lot of folks out there. I did a presentation similar to what we're doing today for the California Chiropractic Board back in May. And it's like the day before FSBPT. Man, these acronyms can get confusing at times. So this is the Federation of the Physical Therapist Board. And they were having a training, a live training like what we're doing right now, implementing a trauma-informed approach in the investigator procedures. And anybody could attend that. You know, they, I think there's like 80 or 90 people there, and it shows your license, and they're all, hey, we're glad to see that there's other than PTs here, and I was one of those other folks. And so for the licensing board and also for the chiropractors in this meeting that we're having right now, look around, because there's a lot of resources available to better educate yourself and come up with some ideas on how you're going to deal with this trauma-informed approach from a regulatory perspective, in this case, investigative procedures. So how about a starting line for us? What could we do as a board? And I want to read this. I think this is a fantastic statement. It says this: trying to implement trauma-specific clinical practices without first implementing trauma-informed organizational cultural change is like throwing seeds on dry land. All right, what's that mean? It means this: start within the four walls. Oh, that's BCE, Board of Chiropractic Examiners. Start within the four walls of the board. Let's just start with us first. Let's see if we can't get a handle on trauma-informed approach. And that would include things like learning about trauma-informed approach, trauma-informed care, like we're doing right now. Taking steps to deal with STS, that is secondary traumatic stress, is the emotional stress that results when an individual hears about the firsthand trauma experiences or another, or if you had a board meeting and somebody's upset about their license. That's just an example. Like, here it is. We live it every day. This secondary traumatic stress. Train the team in trauma-informed investigations. We touched on that. Apply trauma-informed approach to the staff, board members, and third parties. It's important to say, hey, look, the numbers on this are really high. 63%, 70%. This is really high, which means that within the board itself, statistically, a good number of the board members and the staff have a history of trauma as well. What do we do to be sensitive to that within our four walls? That's a really important consideration. And then we come to, I told you I'd give you three. Here's the second one, and that is resist re-traumatization, full stop. That has got to be underscored, 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 and that comes in the way of the complainants themselves. Like I gave that example of how the brain structure is affected with trauma in the way that you process sequentially in events, timelines. They may recount events in a way that doesn't line up with the facts. Be mindful of that. So resisting re-traumatization. Hey, this doesn't make sense. You're not telling the order of events in the way that they really happened. Like, being careful about that. That would apply to the respondents, the licensees, each other, and yourself. Recognizing that if you have a trauma, be kind to yourself. Learn different, you know, mindfulness, breathing techniques, when you need to step out of the room and just say, hey, I need to take a break from all of this. And then take advantage of the many resources that are out there. California has ACEs Aware. Oregon, what do they call it? TIA Oregon, something like that. Anyways, Oregon has some great training material. I mentioned Ohio for the chiropractic board, and there's a couple other resources for you. But that brings us to the end of my presentation for you. I'll leave my slides up if any of you want me to go back to a previous slide, but I am wide open for questions and happy to do that for you.
Dr. Dean, thank you very much. A lot of stimulation for more thought and dialogue, I'm sure. One thing that I hear all of this and I you know want to relate to it is in its best and most effective way as possible. I guess, and boy, this is just really going to the heart of the piece, I think, in some ways. But when we're in a situation where there has to be understanding and compassion, but there also has to be accountability.
Yes.
And that's a big balance. Can you help us with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, being trauma aware is not in any way going down a path of making excuses for behavior. First and foremost is if an individual there's a violation, you know, as it relates to a chiropractic board, I mean, the only thing that we're involved with is violation. Well, I shouldn't say the only thing, but generally the rules and regulations relative to the chiropractor's license. Now, of course, if there's criminal conduct, that factors in as well. But if somebody has a violation, then 100% accountability for that violation and whatever is the appropriate response for that, yes. But on the other hand, it would be problematic. I'll give you an example. I was involved with a case. It was sexual misconduct. No question about the sexual misconduct. ended in revocation with the license. The individual, the chiropractor, had a really, really horrible past history of ACEs. Like, it would have been 10 of 10 on the ACEs score. And it's really quite horrific. I mean, you felt horrible when you understood the history of trauma. In a case like that, I think the board, especially more when you're doing your stipulation and order, is to look at ways that, you know, maybe short of revocation, you know, what could be done towards rehabilitation. So I think trauma factors in mostly on that aspect of a board action. Of course, you're not going to, it's not to make excuse, but on the other hand, be sensitive when it is that you come up with a solution on how to remedy the situation. So I think it really plays in on that side of it.
Thank you. And just following up on that, as you know, you and I met for the first time at the FCL meeting a few weeks ago, and we kind of touched upon this subject, and I've been kind of thinking about it ever since. So I'm glad we're able to have this conversation in a public forum. One of the criticisms that's been levied against our board is, maybe criticism is a too strong a word, but what the board is in question about along these lines of provider remediation and talking about the kinds of things that you're helping us with, the instruments that we use to determine, okay, well, how much of an issue is going on here, and how much are we leaning towards remediation? One instrument that we've used in the past, sparingly, but when appropriate, is the psychosexual evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak to that in terms of whether or not it's within the board's purview, in your opinion, to pursue something like that if we're concerned about a potential high ACEs score on the part of a respondent?
Yeah, certainly. yeah, these are difficult conversations just simply because there's so much to consider. And certainly there might be pushback, you know, let's just say a respondent has an attorney and they're like, no way, we're not doing that. You know, what are you hunting for there? And the fact of the matter is the board's not hunting for anything. We're not looking to hang anybody. We want to be fair about the enforcement process. And being fair is being mindful of the impact of trauma. Not just for the complainant, the patient, the victim, but also for the licensee. And if that is a factor, then the board, I've been asked by ALJs in hearings, would I change my opinion had I had knowledge of certain facts? And the answer is, well, of course. I mean, if it's relevant to the complaint and the violation, of course it's going to impact my opinion. And so too for the board. So I think when it's framed in the context of we're just really trying to do the best we can as a board, due diligence, recognizing the impact of trauma, and that a psychosexual evaluation helps us to better understand that, that's the approach I would take. What are your thoughts?
Pretty much identical to yours. I believe that, and this is my opinion, I'm certainly not for the record speaking on behalf of the board, you know, you've got to be personally as well respond. I am trainable, Mr. Hutchison.
You're so well trained.
I believe that everybody's a human being, and that, if that is a factor and if it is relevant, there are those people who, if we're trying to bring about a change in behavior, you have to be able to know what the causation is behind that change. And
right.
Just, lopping off one's head without, some other potential remedial pathway is, to me, in my mind, at least, a more moral objective. So I guess that's my response. I'd like to ask, are the board members have questions about this?
Yeah, please ask.
Nobody wants to go on record.
Just the madness lives. Doesn't work. Just the madness lives.
How about staff? Any questions coming from staff?
I don't have any. I just kind of want to reiterate the board, but as I think Dr. Green did a great job laying out this presentation. Like, clearly this is on the government's agenda, part of permission. Like, we're working as a staff to really try to incorporate this into our investigative process, into our training and onboarding of our investigators, and to, you know, include you in that kind of different dynamic. And I think part of the discussion we had that was really effective at SCLD, and I know Dr. Bowe is going to provide an update on our meeting, was that Kansas has completely shifted their kind of their mission from to more of a rehabilitation aspect as opposed to revocation, right? Like, the goal is really to, we recognize that we need health professionals. It's so important for our citizens and our public, but how do we do it in a safe manner? And that it's when that becomes the board's objective, it helps and directs you into aiming that. And I think that that really should be something that this board focuses on as we move through some of these growing pains and changes that we're making.
You know, it's funny to hear you say that. I just, you know, I put this slide back up. And it really can be as simple as, this is just like the 4 R's. What are we doing? We're focusing on the 4 R's. You know, the governor, you know, calls you, hey, what are you doing about this? We're focusing on the 4 R's. In fact, in that one page that I pulled that information off the Arizona website, they didn't have all 4 of the R's. They had, I think, 2 of them. But clearly, this is a concept that underpins trauma-informed approach, and that is the 4 R's, realize, recognize, respond, and resist. And then the question is, how do you apply that directly to your license and you know, the patient base that you encounter? And then I think you just really take it to a whole nother level when you ask that question about ourselves within the regulatory process too, because we need to be mindful of the impact that doing the job that we have within enforcement ask the question of trauma and the impact that it has on us individually too. So I think it's really important to address both those aspects.
Thank you. Dr. Small?
Yeah, I had a real brief question. I know that many times depression comes from failed, future expectations that happens to a lot of people in that sense. And you have some of these books here that are repeatable books. And I know that many times I have gotten into the Book of Buddha and has a lot of similar answers, which are similar to probably what you have here in these books. Are these books in a way similar in that, in like the Book of Buddha reading?
No. So The Body Keeps the Score, Bessel van der Kolk, this is really addressing like that HPA access stuff. Like what are the brain, I mean, it definitely, those of you who want an anatomical explanation of what's going on, you're going to get a lot of dialogue about the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex and the lateral aspect and the medial aspect and all that kind of stuff. He really digs in deep into how it is that you have a connection between trauma, changes in the brain architecture, and then the impact on the HPA axis and how that causes sustained chronic inflammation that then causes musculoskeletal conditions that a chiropractor sees. So pardon me?
What you're talking about is a lot of doctor material.
That is correct.
Books right here that you recommend here, are they more for lay people, or are these basically for doctors having the same scientific wording and explanation that you have?
All 3 of those books that you see listed right now, 100% layperson level. You will get it. They do an excellent job of explaining it in simple terms that are understandable. And then like with van der Kolk, he talks a lot about like treatment. How do you go about it? You know, and the fantastic part about it, two big takeaways maybe for us as we wind this down. One question that comes up is, why is it that some people who have a history of trauma have very little long-term effect, and others, it just wipes them out? Like, why does it happen? Because it does. And the variable, the common factor amongst people who are not taken out by trauma is that they have a really strong sense of community, family, social support. And it's kind of cool because when you think about chiropractic, one of the things that kind of happened in a chiropractic office, because we tend to treat people for a long period of time, is you certainly see a kind of community that develops in a chiropractic office. Patients start to see one another. You know, if you can structure that, where perhaps you have, you know, you do exercise, teach people how to exercise or stretch, or, you know, nutrition, you know, chiropractic wellness classes where you have people start to interact not just with the clinic, but they get to meet each other as patients too. It's that sort of thing, community, breathing classes, mindfulness classes. It's that sort of thing that is the difference maker between people who experience trauma, because there's a good chance we all are going to, and they survive it, and they're resilient, and those who it really impacts them in a very negative way. So in your line of questioning regarding, like, what are approaches to deal with trauma, one is whatever it is that it's community-based, because that seems to be a real strong factor. And then two, for the chiropractor, now I'm talking clinically, not board-wise, but those of you who are practicing chiropractors, how do I create that in my practice? And there's all kinds of ways a chiropractor can do that in their practice. So hopefully that's a double bonus, you know. I see you shaking your head, yes, Orlando. That it's like, yeah, you know, we could do this. Oh, my, I see my video stuck. Just a second. Let me unstick it.
Kind of briefly, are these books pretty new? You know, if they're not books that have been around for a while, or, and they are, are there other books similar to this?
Those are the top three I would recommend for you right now. Hopefully my video comes back on in a second. Those are the top three I'd recommend for you at this time. And then we'll work from there. Okay, see if I turn my video. Yay, I'm back. Okay. Yeah, so I just recommend those for now.
Okay. All right, appreciate it. Thank you.
You got it.
Thank you much. I think if we could, you know, one day we'll figure out how dopamine and serotonin and adrenaline go together and work happily.
You got it.
Until then, we'll be working on the rest of this stuff, right?
Fantastic.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time. It's been very valuable, and we will continue our dialogue on this topic into the future. Thank you once again.
Sounds great. Happy to help. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye now.
Very good. Okay, so we have... we just have a couple of reports, executive director's report, a report from our attorney general and from myself, and a call to the public remaining, but we have been at this for an hour now. Let's again take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back and wrap things up after that. So we're back here at 11:20. Very well, we are back in session, and next on the agenda is item number 15, the executive director's report. Xanderine, please present your report.
Great. The first thing that I would like to talk to you about before we get to tasting and all that fun information is the state of Arizona, so all of the executive offices and everything that is under the governor's office are going through a rebranding. So we have a new logo. We, and I think maybe you all noticed the agenda, it looks a little bit broken, have you done that? The website's already been updated. However, we've not received our official version of the logo yet, so we're waiting for that. So once that rolls out, we start implementing that into business cards and things of that nature. So this is what the new logo looks like in the Arizona. That's the website. This is just to give you an idea of where they're going. So all of the offices will have logos like this. This is a garden with tourism. So this is the white and black. That was the black and white version, and then this would be the colored version. So we do have the option where the O is we can have that customized to include some different options, but we decided not to go that route, considering it's like $1,500, so that's just a great
location. Can we have like an atlas? No, I'm just joking.
So I just want you to be aware that we are going to do that kind of thing when people start to see that new logo reflected in the portal. Like I said, a lot of things are already done. We'll start moving towards business cards and other items as once we have our official logo. So, and next in my report is, of course, the status of complaints and where we are. I don't have, on this slide, I don't have 2025 yet. So, yes, we are in 2025. So this is just kind of a look back historically at the total number of complaints, the priority level, so red complaints for high priority, blue is medium, and then the purple is their low priority complaint. Next, I have total complaints that still need initial action. So you'll see 2018 is done through really 2022. We've done initial action on everything through 2022. We're really just dealing with 23, 24, and 25. So the good news is like 2020 will go to zero. Now that we've resolved the list from that case, will go to zero. And then 22 will go down to one because of really essential reforms. So some of those like long-term lingering ones are starting to be wrapped up as we move forward through this. In total, we have a total of 74 open cases. That still includes what we dealt with today. That number will drop. Cases, again, kind of by priority as they were on the agenda. You can see we had that really big, long meeting back in April where we dealt with 28 cases, and then it's been tapered off as we are onboarding new investigators. The slower process, the audit has kind of hindered some of that ability to train and onboard investigators if I don't have the bandwidth and the availability to provide the necessary support to that. So you can see that we're starting to kind of trend back up. And these are closed cases too, by the way. This is not possible anymore on the agenda, but closed. So then in the next thing you'll see things resolve everything that's on the agenda. Total open to closed cases. As you can see, we're really getting close to having, we'll now have 2020 finally closed. We'll be closed on 21 and 22. And then there's only 16 cases remaining in 2023 and staff members discussing that our goal is to have those cases resolved or released on the agenda by January. So that would finish up all of 23, even at 24 and 25. So, if you think back to where we were in 22 when we started, this is significant progress where we still had cases open from 2016 to 2017. So we're really finally kind of moving the needle. Total cases open over 180 days. So that's the recommendation by the Auditor General that we have cases resolved within 180 days. We kind of teeter in that we have usually between 40 and 50 cases that are over that amount, so you can see kind of starts to tick back up as we've been a little bit, have fewer cases on the agenda than the last 2 months. This is just, you can kind of see where cases are in terms of formal interviews, hearings, cases that have stayed or continued by year. We dealt with the formal hearing is that last one, voting form, so that will, those will come off since we don't have any at formal hearing. You really just have cases, those 5 cases that are stayed up to date. This is an update on licensing applications. This is kind of a look back. You can see we're kind of starting to trend down in applications received. We have some regression around that, that potentially that could have to do with this county park that is last meeting. The request of the challenges in our language regarding applications and do they meet the qualifications because of that residency requirement. So that could be part of it, plus it could be less people are coming to Arizona now that we're kind of through that big influx. And so things are kind of starting to stabilize. So we'll just keep monitoring that, see how that is. And then this is for dual applications. I added this because, as you guys probably can't believe it, all the time to start doing my home again. That's still where we just finished. But now that it will be rolling, so we'll start the first half of month renewal starting in January. I'll assume this number here is going to be over the course of the year. We've already had 49 licenses, or 25. Those are licenses that were issued last year that we didn't put them on the extended track because our licenses just come due. So we just let them renew where they should have renewed based on where the work date and our license being issued.
Any questions?
Continuing education applications, we've already received the applications for the year. This is about how far where we usually are. We've received 18 new classes from the student house. Just 40 pending, so that's the best part of it. So, anyway. So, the other item I wanted to talk to you about was the budget. We've not had this discussion, I don't think, but in as part of the FY 2025 budget, the legislature swept from the board's reserve account $500,000 to fund a general budget shortfall. So you'll see in the end of 2024, I know this is like the most easy budget to read, but you'll see that our expenses were significantly higher than that $500,000. So we had over $1 million in expenses last year, including that $500,000 last week. So we brought in significant revenue, and then they swept it. So the concern I have, and I've talked to OSPD, which is the governor's office of budget and future planning, is that we have in our reserve account right now $388,000. We have not had any income come in since we have a target rule. So that will start in January, but we are appropriated for $643,000. We obviously, without the necessary revenue coming, don't have the revenue to support the appropriation. Because they took, we had, at the end of 2024, we had over $900,000, and so then they took $500,000. So just be mindful that you're closely monitoring that, and I project that once renewals and that income are coming in monthly, the number will start to look better. But that's where we are at the moment.
A couple questions. Can you confirm that these things also occurred in other regulatory boards?
Yes, 50 boards, all 28 boards were left for a total of $50 million.
Okay, and my understanding is that this was once done a number of years ago. Something similar to this was done a number of years ago, and my understanding was that it was potentially litigated.
It was the professional associations that went forward and did that. It was the board members themselves, but it was the association.
It was successfully challenged, correct?
Yeah.
Is there any effort underway at this point in time that you're aware of relative to that?
I heard there were talks, but I don't know if that was over if they went forward. I know people were reaching out to the attorney that litigated it for racial matching.
Any questions from the board on this? Thank you.
So the next slide kind of shows like where we are in terms of utilizing our appropriation, revenue, income, and expenditures. So the blue line represents time, and the red represents our expenditures to the appropriation. And then the green represents our revenue. So we've got 4% of our projected revenue in. We've only spent 23% of our appropriation, and we've been allotted 50% of our appropriation. So we get the appropriation support on installments over the next year, so quarterly. So we received the first one in July and the second one in October. So we've received 50% of the appropriation, and we've only extended out 23%.
So in similar layman's terms, we're under budget year to date.
We are under budget year to date, but the reason we are under budget year to date is we are still short 2,000. So this is an update on FinChip, so let's talk about FinChip. We are continuing to work on enhancements and improvements with FinChip. We also engaged and took out a contract with an IT specialist who specializes in FinChip, so they were working with other boards to assist with additional improvements and enhancements, like specifically reporting requirements, those things that weren't quite so relevant where staff doesn't have the bandwidth to really create that and develop that. So we are working with them on that. We updated and added new reports for licensure renewals and application tracking. This is kind of help improve things, taking more streamlined. We've implemented in one of the newer releases of NCA Dominus an automated letter complaint. So we don't have to copy and paste letters in to NCA anymore. This was an automatic template where we can just populate that information and then submit that letter to the world. So that's occurring, reducing staff workload. So just kind of working through some of those things. We are in the process of developing a couple of efficiency labs, and this is where we're working with IT consultants, where licensees will be better able to track their incomplete application. So we send out a deficiency letter, an incomplete letter, so if you're missing all these things, and then they start submitting them, this screen and this letter will allow staff to update it as we receive things. So they just get a new letter every time we receive something, so it's like your fingerprint are updating. We can put a new one that says, okay, we got your fingerprints, but your transcripts are going out. Okay. Like, it's just kind of moved down the item as you receive them, so they have a better idea of where they are in the application process. And we just issue them a new letter every time you complete something. So that's what we do.
Is there any possibility of a similar type of computer-generated timely periodic deficiency letter that could be generated to renewals, such that instead of finding out that their license is under administrative suspension because they didn't get their CEs done, they might in 90 days in advance say, hey, you don't have your CEs done, you know, that kind of thing?
That is probably going to fall more under the implementation of the CE broker, if we're aware of that.
Okay,
so does that make sense? Because the deficiency letter is more, you put your application in, and the transcripts and the test scores and your fingerprints come in separate from the application. So it's kind of piecing all of that together. And so that's kind of where that communication is important, where your renewal, it will let you renew until you put your CE in, right? But then we have to come back and forth because you have to put those pictures had into your CE, right? Like that's more where the disconnect happens. But CE broker will say, you have 12 hours due, and your 12 hours due by this, and you put in 6 of your 12 hours. You know, so it will monitor more like that, then that will be built as that data shares with NCS.
Okay, so it interface with CD Broker, who are also in dialogue.
We are, and I can provide an update right now regarding that. We are in discussions with CD Broker. I am working with State Procurement, so SPO, in regards to finalizing the contract. There's a lot of dialogue back and forth about, because there's no cost to the board, how, like, what we're purchasing. So we're just kind of working through this agreement to get to something so the state's happy and the board can get what it needs. So we're working on that. The priority first part of what we will implement with CE Broker will be the CE Provider Application Portal. That will be the first step. Just because I didn't want to get halfway through renewals, it's like, okay, now we have to switch again, and you have to do your CEs, and like 50% of you will have to do a CE broker. So the goal would be to have the CE provide, like the provider done first, and then have next year for renewals have licensees move to utilizing CE broker for that.
Okay, thank you.
2025 renewal date. Okay, so in anticipation of preparing for January, we are getting ready to sell next week, can you believe it? Renewal notices. So they will be sent out U.S. mail, email, and then through the NCO portal. We are highlighting items of attention to ensure a renewal process, smooth process, so it will be a little bit different. Again, that's where some of these reports have come in. We'll be able to run a report track to see where everybody is. We sent out multiple communications to prepare licensees for these changes. We sent one out on October 1st, another on October 12th. The email result was we had 74% of open rate on all of those emails. So we sent it in two different formats, one in the longer newsletter format, and then another one with a link to the memo report provided. That's what we put on the board's website as well. We did update all of the websites, have current information, updated a how-to guide to eliminate steps that we were no longer using, so to show you what the extension fees we removed that step from the how-to guide. Additionally, we updated the auto-attendance on the board's phone line to create call queues to better triage phone calls, but also manage them. So you can call the office, enter the menu, how to find the renewal date, how to check the key. Like, those options are in the phone now, so I have talked to staff who can just select the menu, hear a message, and then also get directions to the correct support website to help answer that. So we've also migrated, and we did migrate back in July to a new phone system. So we're no longer on the state asset-supported phone system. We've moved to this new platform, which is a digital platform. All handle any kind of app. So we're moved to cell phones, utilizing the app, which makes it a more seamless transition between working in the office and working from home. But we also have data. We've not had data in the past, and we have a lot of people that are like, I've called, and called, and called, so we never. In September, we received 407 calls. Of those 407 calls, 169 were calls to investors, 311 were answered by board staff, 59 calls were abandoned before staff could answer, before they were forwarded to the board of call. Again, like I stated earlier, include those auto attendants to help address some of those questions when the board staff's not available. It also includes after-hour messages, holiday messages. We also can program it for board meetings so that, like, they were all passed here, obviously, they'll be here as well. It gives full insight to calls, how long they are, what path they went, how many, you know, iterations did they move away from. You can see all of that, and then like I said, staff to the top of the cell phone, would take that as a lot more seamless. And that is it. My update. Do you have any questions for me?
A lot of data. Any questions from board members?
How does that work?
It's called Zoom Phone. It's a platform. It's linked directly to our main number, so our main number. We now can set up call queues, meaning depending on what you're calling about, you can select from a menu of options. So if you want to talk to investigations, you can click investigations, and then I would call it a hunt, but it's called a call queue. So it goes to Connie first, and Connie doesn't answer, it goes to Laura, and then it goes to me. Right, and if I don't answer, then it goes to Connie's voice account. And so it just kind of allows more of us to be involved in answering those calls and helping with overflow. Because, like, if it calls and Connie's on the phone, it automatically raises them for us. So trying to help, you know, funnel those calls appropriately, but also have a menu of options. Maybe you don't need to talk to staff, but you just need, you know, however
they
do, well,
with
that, they will direct
you
to the board website.
You know,
is there any way you can give us a little email on this long Zoom call so we can have it and people talk about, yeah, you know, well, I've been calling the board, I go, why have you done this, and, you know,
The slides are in my materials in your board folder. In your electronic board folder.
Okay.
My board report out in my slides are in there.
Yes.
All right. So I've used it, but I've had somebody say I've been trying to renew for a year and nobody at the board's office is giving me answers to my calls. And so I looked up his phone number and I've already seen call time. And
yeah, we're struggling because we've all had those phone calls. And God bless him. But more importantly, what I really like about what I'm hearing and what you're doing and the staff are doing is it is frustrating to have an important thing that you're concerned about and not have some kind of contact. And that adds the frustration to both ends. And so we're proactively trying to get more communication actually happening and take that level down so that it's increasing. And I think that's a healthy, that's a good thing.
I completely agree. And like the staff is returning phone calls 24 to 48 business hours, and you really have to try to emphasize that because I can't tell you how many I get, and they're like, well, I called Friday at 3 o'clock, and nobody called me back until it's Monday, nobody was here, right? Like.
Yeah. Like I said, we've all plenty of those.
I know. So we're trying to proactively address.
And I think you are, and thank you. Any other questions? Okay, the next item on the agenda is the Assistant General's report slash update of the Federation of Associations of Regulatory Boards, FARB, Annual Conference, Innovation and Regulation.
So our annual conference was last month in Atlanta. As the name implies, about half of it was about, I don't know, newer psychometrics and testing. But usually the way they did it is they had, there would be breakout sessions for those, and then there'd be the law sessions by next month of the testing. Conversation and that through a few legal updates from across the country with other jurisdictions, legislators or what laws are going through, how they are adapting to those changes. A big topic of discussion on both sides of that was AI and what that's going to look like, how we can sort of try and head off some of the impacts that's inevitably going to have in all of these professions and regulating them. Another big topic of discussion was the Supreme Court Loper Bright decision that did away with the Chevron deference doctrine, but that was not, all of the other jurisdictions had a lot to say about that, except for Arizona, because Arizona has not had Chevron deference for the past 4 years or so, 4 or 5, and briefly Chevron deference is that reviewing courts will defer to an agency's reasonable interpretation of statute, but again, Arizona has done that for some time, so we were out there in the corner just observing their panel, answering questions. But it was a good conference. It's always good to see what all the other jurisdictions are doing, what the landscape looks like across the country. If anyone has any questions about FAR, they'd be able to answer them.
What was that word you said? The new word you learned?
Oh, psychometric.
I'm more with the national board, you can hear that a lot. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. And thank you for attending. Next on the agenda is item 18, report from the chair, summary of current events and an update on the Federation of Chiropractic Licensing Board's annual district meeting. In this Powell's absence, I will present this update. The Federation of Chiropractic Licensing Board, as Dr. Green commented, is an entity that basically provides services to virtually every licensed chiropractic licensing board in the United States, Mexico, all Canadian provinces, and I believe 9 foreign countries. And there are 2 meetings per year that are held, 1 annual, 1 district. We are in District 4. We attended the District 1 and 4 annual meeting here in Sheffield about 3 weeks ago. We had good attendance. We had Connie and Venerdy and Mr. Hutchison, and is that it? And then Ms. Howell and myself. And I was just comment presenters on various topics of regulatory concern, along with multiple work group discussions, sharing best practices on specific chiropractic regulatory issues, including resources available to boards to enhance investigative effectiveness, including use of instruments such as the ethics and boundaries assessment, the psychosexual evaluations, etc. That's a conversation that I had with Dr. Green that I was referring to. Evolving trends in regulating sexual misconduct matters. There's a lot of going on, and I'm happy to say that some of what we've done as a board and Alyssa and staff have done, Ms. Vanity and staff have done, was well received by the other boards and work groups in terms of identifying levels of sexual gender issues and so forth. So this is a topic of interest that is national, if not international in nature. Trends in regulating regarding artificial intelligence. And at this point, it's 2 things. Reveal claim responsibility. So we are going to be seeing artificial intelligence programs. Literally, there are programs where you can walk into a room with a cell phone, turn it on. It will record the encounter. It will populate your electronic medical records with the information that you've decided COVID to populate with and give you your medical records. Which sounds wonderful, except that you have to do 2 things. You have to say, okay, I use AI, and you have to say, and I'm still responsible for whatever the content is. And more to evolve on that, most certainly, in the future. The roles of regulatory boards regarding advocacy and public policy matters. I was privileged to make a presentation on that. Statutory language changes needed to keep up with trends such as online college curricula. And one of the things that was discussed in one of the work groups that relates to the records report was encouraging the board to provide incentives for people to interact with board matters by offering continuous opportunities. And for example, they have things where once they has a board update with kind of pay attention to this, pay attention to that, and then you take the quiz at the end of it and you get an hour or 2 of continuing education plan. So those are some ideas that were discussed, and we've had a little bit of dialogue on that. So we were well represented. Always come away from these FCLB meetings with good information on a broader, you know, up to a 500-foot level. We're all dealing with a lot of the same things, and they thought about this, maybe we could do that. So it's a good sharing up, and I encourage ongoing representation, robust ongoing representation by our board in the future. Any questions? Hearing none. Next on the agenda is item 8, the call to the public. You have up to 2 minutes to make a statement on the record. This is not meant to be a two-way dialogue. The board will not discuss or take action on matters raised during the call to the public that are not explicitly identified on the agenda, but may respond to criticisms as staff to review a matter or ask the matter be placed on a future agenda. The board may impose on speakers reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. Speakers are cautioned to refrain from discussing confidential information, and if such a dialogue occurs, that dialogue will be terminated. So let's start by having those in the room. Yes, doctor, please approach the microphone and turn it on so that there's a green button so that you may be heard.
Thank you for your service and supporting chiropractic. I appreciate you all. I would like to formally request a future board meeting for a discussion for phase 6 digital x-rays potential options to be put on the docket in the future after the audit. New information, got an email from Bernardo Luna, licensing manager at the Bureau of the Health Department, in the Green Health agreeable to 3228-7G4. And then an agreeable conversation with Hunter Bergen, X-ray program manager at the Med Bureau. If he cannot interpret 3228-11D4, so that for years they've been using handbook to help chiropractors, dentists, and psychiatrists have an exemption to the equipment. But our rule, 4711-3D1, is actually the reason that CA can't. And it's now possible there's a legislation exemption in there. He stated to have the Attorney General interpret it, and did. Well, the Attorney General office was done to interpret research in a letter from the Mr. Settlement in 1982. The letter summarized 3228-11D4 and 30-672D. Were not licensed by Red Tech. Therefore, there's no ordering, no interpretation, as for the doctor. But yes, persons assisting are exempt from MRTEN and take x-rays when the four rules prevent. I've got Bob Morgan, Attorney General, a little change seems qualitative, and there might be another rule we have to look at. Successful options such as Texas is one of 15 DC training in office only. That's for lower board involvement. I would credit Dr. Powers to Georgia, Colorado, 24 hours online, or Georgia with 6 hours online. I suggest 2 hours online, the doctor in out hours, the digital, which is just enough to teach. But he is, maybe, when his chiropractor assistant coined. Maybe to help anybody on board, if you know.
Thank you for your comments, Dr. And, just one response that I can make. In the call to the public is to request the discussion of the IP placed on the agenda, which I'm now.
Thank you.
Any other, we now have an opportunity for those of you online to raise your hands for a call to the public. And so if you wish to make a statement in the call to the public, please raise your hand virtually. I don't have a full screen. Can anybody inform me if there's a hand up?
I have no hand up.
Okay, calling out a second time. Anyone interested in our virtual attendee call to the public? Asking a third time. Seeing or hearing of none, that completes our call to the public. The next regular meeting is scheduled with the board. It's scheduled for Wednesday, December 11th, 2024 at 9 a.m. in this location, 1740 West Adams Street, Boardroom C. And with that, it is now 11:55, and this meeting, Mr. Hutchison.
Just one quick question from the board. In addition to what was previously discussed in the call cover, is there any other discussion about future agenda? I thought that was another
I don't have that in mind.
It's not on your script to me, but
oh, that would explain it. So,
I think your script is probably really cool.
Thank you. Is there any discussion of future agenda items? Okay, well, I'm glad we checked that item off. That said, it is now 11:56, and this board meeting stands.